Good evening. This is Radio Liberty coming to you. And we give our telephone number, 464-8295, if you'd like to call in this evening. But first of all, hold your calls because we have an exciting guest, first off. We have with us tonight Mr. John Toland. Mr. John Toland is the author of the classic book on Pearl Harbor entitled Infamy.
I read this book about 10 years ago, and I've read an awful lot of books on Pearl Harbor and the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. But this book was the classic and really the ultimate book because it showed really a number of years of research, actually going and talking to the people who were there. Now, most of those people have subsequently died, but over a period, I suspect 8 or 10 years, John Toland went from person to person and talked to all the people who played a key part in the tragic story of Pearl Harbor. And, of course, what you must understand is that the history of government is a history of lying to the public. Now, we saw, of course, in the Watergate debacle, it really wasn't much of a bad thing at all. It was simply a break-in at a hotel to determine, at least the story is, whether or not the members of the Democratic Central Committee were getting funds from Castro's Cuba. The problem was that the president lied about his knowledge. He didn't order it. Somebody else ordered it. But he was trying to protect those people around him, and he lied to the American people repeatedly. Well, it led to the impeachment of the President of the United States. And then, of course, subsequently we saw Iran-Contra-Gate. We'll never get to the bottom of that because George Bush has now pardoned many of the people who could have led the trail right to the very top, the people in key positions who were lying. Many of the people, of course, Poindexter and North, admitted lying about what they were doing, and it was really so foolish. They didn't have to lie about it at all. All they had to do was say, you know, we don't believe that the executive branch of government is under the control of the Congress, and we can do what we think is right to protect our nation. After all, the President of the United States was elected by the American people. That's all they had to say. They didn't have to get into this whole tragic situation of not telling the American people the truth. But now we have an entirely different story. We have a story where it wasn't just simply a matter that somebody lied, but there were thousands of American lives that were lost at Pearl Harbor. The question was, did the President of the United States know that the attack was going to occur? Did he intentionally leave the boys there to be slaughtered to create a spectacle which would rally the American people behind the President and get us into a war in Europe, which was President Roosevelt's goal? In fact, he had already promised he was going to get us into the war, even when he was campaigning in 1940, promising that American boys would never fight on foreign soil. But the tragedy was that after the Pearl Harbor, the American commanders, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, were then forced to bear the responsibility. Now, we have Mr. Toland back. Let's see if we have a better line here. We're having a lot of thunder and lightning. I hope we didn't get any problems. We didn't lose any of our power. We had Mr. Toland there for just a minute. He was on the line, and suddenly the line went dead. And so my trusty producer, Carolyn, hopefully will go ahead and try once more to get him on the line. We had him there. He was there, and suddenly he's gone. Anyway, the amazing story of what happened at Pearl Harbor has been intentionally and purposely confused. And there has been one of the greatest cover-ups of all time, quite comparable to the cover-up of the assassination of John Kennedy, to prevent the truth about what's going on from ever being brought to the American public. Because, you see, the American public hopefully would realize that a government that would betray its fighting men would also betray its citizens. So let's try and see if we have Mr. Toland here once again. Mr. Toland?
Yeah?
Oh, that sounds quite a bit better. How long did you spend researching your book, Infamy?
I researched Infamy about a year, but I had information on this in my first book, The Rising Sun, which took me 6 years. I found out after 8 years that I had made a very bad mistake in my book on the Rising Sun, which won the Pulitzer Prize, by stating that Roosevelt did not know that the Japanese carrier force was coming. I got so many phone calls, telegrams, and letters from high-ranking naval and army people telling me, no, that was not true. The president did know. But that's when I researched again, and I found out I had made a mistake, and that's why I wrote the book Infamy.
All right. Well, but now, did these officers who talked to you or who told you that the president didn't know, were they willing to be willing to be quoted?
Oh yes, they all were very happy to be quoted. I quote them in my book.
All right. Well, one of the most fascinating parts of the book, as I remember, was the story of the wind's message. Would you like to tell the listening audience about the importance of the wind's message and how pressure was put on various military officers to get them to just to say that it didn't occur?
Well, the wind's message was when the Japanese were trying to hide the fact that they were going to attack. And so their people announced that when they said east wind rain, that would mean to their people outside that the attack on the United States was about to begin. And for many years it was believed that the U.S. never got that message. And
officers who talked to you or who told you that the president didn't know, were they willing to be willing to be quoted?
Oh yes, they all were very happy to be quoted. I quote them in my book.
All right. Well, one of the most fascinating parts of the book, as I remember, was the story of the wind's message. Would you like to tell the listening audience about the importance of the wind's message and how pressure was put on various military officers to get them to just to say that it didn't occur?
Well, the wind's message was when the Japanese were trying to hide the fact that they were going to attack. And so their people announced that when they said east wind rain, that would mean to their people outside that the attack on the United States was about to begin. And for many years it was believed that the U.S. never got that message and never understood what it meant. Until in my research on Infamy, I found the Navy man who was on the job and who received the message, and he received it very clearly, and he passed it on to the head of Naval Intelligence in Washington. And this man also passed it on to other people. But this man, he was the most intelligent man we had in the Navy. And he had broken many codes. But because he insisted he got the wind's message, it ruined his career.
And wasn't it that many of the other officers had actually heard the wind's message, sort of came to deny it because of pressure that was put on them?
Well, you see, the wind's message was heard by this enlisted man who was on duty to receive it. And when he received it, he reported it to Washington.
Right.
And this man in Washington, who was one of our top people in naval intelligence, passed it on, but nobody would believe him afterwards when he was interrogated.
All right, fine.
And so this man, who was a brilliant man, and later contributed so much that after the war, President Eisenhower gave him a reward of $50,000 for what he had done. His reputation was ruined because of this, and I tell all that sordid story in my book.
Well, it's a tragic story. One of the most fascinating parts of the story was the fact that we were actually tracking the Japanese fleet, and we knew it was off the north shore or northwest shore of Hawaii. Would you like to tell us that story and the background of how you uncovered it?
I uncovered that story from the Netherlands naval attaché. At the time, he was a captain, Captain Johan Ranoff. He later became an admiral. I discovered him after a long time, and I found he was in Texas. I went to Texas and interviewed him, and he, in the presence of his son, he told me this story, that he had gone to naval intelligence on December 2nd, and while he was there in this office, he was informed that two Japanese carriers apparently were heading east, and he then came back on the night before Pearl Harbor. That was on December 6th. It was the afternoon, and he asked, "Where are those wandering Japanese carriers?" And the man in charge of naval intelligence, and I give his name is Wilkinson, had a man point to place some 250 miles from Pearl Harbor and said, "They are here, sir."
So the day before Pearl Harbor, we actually knew, and the naval officers knew where they were, but they didn't tell the commanders at Pearl Harbor that they were there.
Yes. Now, many people said that I got false information that this did not happen. And they said, "Why would we allow Captain Ranoff into our top naval intelligence office?" The reason was that Captain Ranoff had been asked by the Navy to get the plans for the Bofors anti-aircraft gun because we had a very poor one. He risked his reputation, got the plans for the Bofor gun, and this was one of the reasons we won some of our naval battles. Because of that, he was also given the highest award that we give to a foreigner. That's why he was there. And then they say, "What was your proof?" Well, my proof is that when I was talking with Ranoff, he said he had put this in his naval record and had sent the information not only to his ambassador in Washington, but to his people they were then stationed in England. And he said, "I think you will find this in my record." I got in touch with the Dutch, and they found the record, and they found the entire month of December 1941 was intact. And I quote this in my book, and I give a picture of it, in which states about exactly what I've been telling you, that they told him there were these two carriers were approximately 300 miles or so westerly.
Now, for the listening audience, I think it's important that they understand what had actually happened. The military officers, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, had been told to be on sabotage alert, that if an attack came, it was going to come in the South Pacific. And, of course, the sabotage alert meant we bunched all of our planes together so that they could be more easily guarded, but also they were a very, very effective target at that time. And, of course, the other thing was that they were told to do nothing to alarm the people in Hawaii. Admiral Kimmel wanted to take his fleet out of Pearl Harbor. Even though all the carriers were gone, they had nothing to guard the battleships with. He at least could have taken the carriers to sea, but he had been specifically instructed to do nothing to alarm the people on Hawaii. And so had he taken the fleet to sea, that certainly would have alarmed the people. And everything was done to convince the military commanders in Pearl Harbor that the attack was going to come, if it did, in the far Pacific, not at Pearl Harbor, so that they were left there just as sitting ducks, our boys on the Arizona and the other battleships. Is that about the way you sized it up?
Yes. What I can't understand is why people will not face the fact of what General Marshall had to do with this. They keep saying that he didn't know anything about the attack, that he wasn't even in Washington at the time. The next morning he was out riding horseback, when I have evidence that he was at headquarters that morning And he, see, the day before, the Japanese had sent a message, and everything was translated except the last two paragraphs, which didn't come in until the morning. The last two paragraphs indicated absolutely that there was going to be war. Now, Marshall knew this, even when he said he only found out maybe about 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that. But when this, when he had this message, how do you think he informed Kimmel in Pearl Harbor? Would you think he'd pick up a telephone and tell him? No. They were afraid it might be bugged or something, and instead they sent it to Western Union, and it didn't arrive until after the attack.
So you wouldn't want to go through military channels. You went through Western Union,
Western Union.
It would be open to anybody who worked for Western Union.
And it took another 5 hours to get there.
And the Western Union telegram arrived shortly after the attack was already underway.
That's right.
Well,
but there were so many lies told about this that they accomplished.
And they're still telling the lies about
yes.
it. In fact, there are new books coming out all the time trying to convince us that the government did not betray those boys who went down on the Arizona.
And the sad thing is that I consider Roosevelt one of our better presidents. He was a great man, but he did lie. He thought he was doing the best. He was under... See, let me explain. The information was that there were two Japanese carriers, see? He figured that they would never do any damage because our intelligence said the Japanese were poor flyers, their ships were not much good, and he was informed by Marshall that Pearl Harbor was safe from any attack. And I think if they, he didn't want to alert Pearl Harbor because he wanted the first bomb to be dropped and it wouldn't do much harm. And then he could go to war. You see, Roosevelt wanted to get into the war against Hitler. But Hitler refused to attack or anything like that. And so I think they got into the war in the back door. And the tragedy is that Roosevelt, who was a very efficient president and did wonderful things, actually did something that if it happened today, it would cause a tremendous scandal.
Well, of course, my concern was the fact that they lied to the American public about this.
And they lied afterward in the numerous investigations. I go through all the investigations, and the reputations of good men were ruined because what they said were turned to be supposed to be lies when the other people were lying.
Now, did you have any pressure put on you or any sharp criticism of you because of your expose of what had transpired?
Not by the Navy, no.
No, but by the media.
By the media, yes. Before this, I would say 90% of my reviews would be very, very good. I didn't get a single good review from a decent newspaper except the New York Times, which always gave me good reviews. The Washington Post blasted me when the book was sent to the Washington Post. I was called up by the woman that was running the special Sunday Times book review because I reviewed for her, and she said, "John, you're getting a terrible review." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "We didn't do it. The book was taken away from us, and it's being done by the editorial department."
Uh-huh.
And they blasted almost everything I said in the book. Today, most of those things are accepted as true, and said it was the end of my reputation. And then this time, this Washington Post review was repeated over and over again. When I went to Chicago, I was insulted. I had a tough time all over until I got down to... I've only got good treatment when I got to Dallas, Texas.
Well, unfortunately, there was a coordinated effort all across America, and it is coordinated and organized to discredit anyone who tries to tell the truth about the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. Now, we're going to open up our lines.
When I got to San Francisco, I was supposed to be the top talker at a book and author after session. I got there and they said, no, it's been canceled.
Well, I remember hearing you on KGO about 10 years ago on a talk program, and I thought you did very well. But the man who interviewed you obviously was a little sympathetic. I'm going to open up our telephone lines if anybody would like to call at 464-8295, and you'll have a chance to talk to John Toland, who's an internationally known author and a researcher. You did a wonderful book on the fall of the Third Reich. What was the name of that?
Adolf Hitler.
Adolf Hitler. In fact, one of the most interesting parts of that book, I remember, was the story of how Lord Lothian went to visit Hitler. Probably didn't mean much to most of your listeners or readers. Probably may not have meant anything to you, but it helped me to understand the relationship between the small group of British aristocrats and the government of the Third Reich, this small group of English aristocrats, of which Lord Lothian was one, who had their own agenda and who actually were encouraging Hitler at every turn. But that's an entirely different subject. And then your story on the Rising Sun, wasn't that it?
The Rising Sun was the first book that wrote about the war in the Pacific, not only from the American and British side, but from the Japanese side.
And, of course,
I spent many years in Japan interviewing.
Now, basically, wasn't it that we actually put so much pressure on Japan that economically they had no alternative but to go to war?
Yes, they didn't want to go to war. And as I tell in Infamy, you know, they sent an offer in November to the United States. When Roosevelt read it, he thought it was a good offer, and he wrote a reply to it, accepting it. But he was sick at the time. It was turned over to the Secretary of State. And he sent this message, guess where? To China and to Britain to get their approval of it.
And of course,
they raised the devil, and it was never sent. And instead, several days later, Roosevelt discovered that there was some movement of troops going to the south, and they sent a reply that was an insult to the Japanese because our offer was worse than the offer we had given before, and that's what started off the war.
But, you know, I think the listeners, probably most of them may be too young to remember the fact that we put an embargo on raw materials so Japan
that's
could
right.
not...
We cut them off from our oil.
And
this was done, and still the Japanese were willing to negotiate.
And to the listener, they must understand that Japan had no oil. And by putting an absolute arms embargo so Japan could not buy oil anywhere in the world, it meant that the whole infrastructure of their society would crumble within about 6 months. In other words, we put them into the position where they either had to go to war or literally give up their national independence.
They would have to become a second-rate nation.
And because of the Japanese outlook, the importance of, you know, your name, they look at the world entirely different. Honor is an important thing with the Japanese. And if a man loses his honor, why, he has to commit suicide. He has no other alternative. And there was just no way that they could be pushed into the position that we were pushing them in. But, of course, we wanted the war. That's what the American people don't understand. We had already made secret commitments to go into the war. Since we couldn't get Hitler to attack us, we had to manipulate the Japanese. In fact, I went back to Yale University, went through Secretary of War Stimson's diary, which is there, and held in my hand the page where he said the only question, we wanted to get into the war, the only question was how we could do it and get the Japanese to fire the first shot.
That's it.
And we did it, and the American people never realized that, you know, we knew where the Japanese fleet was. We knew it was off the North Shore. Was it north or west? Doesn't really matter. We knew it was close to Japan. Finally to Pearl Harbor, and yet we never told the commanders there so that they could prepare themselves or they could protect our fighting men. And over 2,000 went down in the Arizona, and they're still interred in that ship. And you can go to Pearl Harbor today, and you can still see the ship there, just the mast sticking up, and the bodies are still there in the boat. Living memento to what I believe was a day in infamy, admittedly, but not as President Roosevelt would have us believe. Well, are you doing any more writing these days?
Oh, yes. I just finished another book on the private life of Hitler. That'll be out in a couple of years, and now I'm working on my autobiography.
Well, you've certainly done a wonderful job getting information out, information that really was unavailable any other place. And I think one of the most interesting things about your book was simply giving exact replicas or reduplication of many of the hearings in Washington, D.C., and showing the techniques that were used by the administration lawyers to discredit and to confuse anybody who tried to tell the truth. There were a number of transcripts that you included in your book, telling who was the commander or who had broken the codes?
Safford.
Safford. And when
he was one of the heroes of my book, and he was the one that fought to get the truth told, because, see, he was the one that that was in charge of naval intelligence, you know.
And they destroyed
his
crew.
He had all the information. And he gave his information, and he was cut down and made to look as though he were lying.
And of course, it's interesting when you read the transcripts, you can see how these clever lawyers can distort the truth and can utilize words. They can confuse the witness. And if you've ever been on the witness stand, you know what a clever lawyer can do. But the whole purpose of the lawyers was to conceal the truth from the American public. And when it did come out in the transcripts, of course, nobody ever had an opportunity to read them, because certainly the Washington Post wasn't going to reduplicate those.
Well, and how about when we had the final naval and army investigations, that some of the truth did come out, but it was kept quiet because this was the year just before the election, and the public was never told that the men that had been accused of lying, the Safford and others, were telling the truth, and the fault lay not in Pearl Harbor, but in Washington, D.C.
And, of course, it was in the name of national security that none of
That's
this information
right.
could be put out. And, of course, at that time you might justify it because we were still at war. But the same excuses would be given today on John Fitzgerald Kennedy's assassination. We have to keep the record secret for national security purposes.